Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us today on this Monday is my good friend Byron Callen of Capital Alpha Partners, the independent Washington research firm, to give us a sense on what's ahead this week. Byron, thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Vago.
Absolute pleasure. And I'm sorry you couldn't join us for the roundtable on Friday. You're always a key contributor on that. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage, and General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. Byron, every Sunday night, you put a note out to your clients on some thoughts you've got, as well as what to pay attention to, you know, events over the coming week. Everybody obviously has been talking about the president's hospitalization. There wasn't a news station that wasn't providing pretty much 24/7 coverage of that. Obviously, we want the president, the first lady, and everybody infected to recover as quickly as possible. A little bit of a dispute on exactly how sick the president is, despite his sort of late evening or evening ride to visit his supporters right outside Walter Reed Hospital. Talk to us a little bit about your impressions about how this moves the needle. You know, some people are saying the adversaries will take advantage of the distraction or Washington's distraction to get up to no good. There is a little bit of a sense of that. For example, the crisis between Armenia and Azerbaijan that involves Turkey directly is something that apparently has stalled a little bit, in part because of the president's hospitalization. Walk us through how you perceive this situation, where we're going, and how it impacts defense, if at all, right? It seems like it has more of a political impact than a national security one, but what's your sense?
Well, yeah, there are really two different lanes to walk down. The first is just the budget process, and I'm sure as you all talked about on Friday, there's really not a lot going on for defense. The FY21 appropriations and National Defense Authorization Act, you know, those are both going to be taken up after the election. The Department of Defense is now finalizing its FY22 budget request, but the president typically wouldn't get involved in that in any way, shape, or form. So put the budget aside, I really don't think much is going to happen on that front. And then you're right, I don't think that as much as this is a tumultuous time, I don't think it means an instant skyrocketing in geopolitical risk. And the reason I say that is, you know, first, there's precedent. I think Dwight Eisenhower, when he was president, had a massive heart attack in 1955, when JFK was assassinated in 1963, and then when Ronald Reagan was shot in 1982, I believe, or 81, I'm sorry. You know, in all three cases, you couldn't point to adversaries, you know, kind of throwing down the gauntlet and taking bold, aggressive action. And I think they just have to be mindful that, you know, as much as one person has been impacted, the foundation of U.S. military power and strength hasn't changed because of that. And they're calculus about what they can accomplish by taking bold and aggressive action at this time. I just don't think it's changed. So that doesn't mean that there aren't sparks that could cause, a conflict or a problem to come up. But I think those are kind of ongoing and probably haven't changed that much as a result of the president getting COVID-19.
But couldn't you also argue, though, Byron, right, from a historical perspective, Dwight Eisenhower stood astride the world, the likes of which no American president probably has in decades. The United States had overwhelmingly the largest economy in the world. We had the largest nuclear arsenal. You know, we could destroy other great powers as we did in Suez by humiliating France, Britain, Israel, etc. When we chose to do that, there were some who think that somehow President Trump's thinking sort of mirrors that. He has Eisenhower-like powers, whereas the United States, you know, is 25% of the world economy, not, you know, more than 50% as it was at that time. I mean,
Well, yeah. I mean, you never say never, Vago. I could think of, you know, just off the tip of my tongue. Look, you know, Iran just sent two tankers, and I think a third is on its way to Venezuela if it's not there already. The U.S. didn't interfere with the passage of those vessels. Could it interfere? And that triggers a broader crisis in the Middle East. Iraq, you know, there was a missile attack, a rocket attack on Erbil, the air base there last week. You know, could the Iranians or the Iranian-backed militias get another lucky strike off and kill American service people? You mentioned Armenia and Azerbaijan. You know, at what point does that bring in Russia or Turkey? I don't know, but that's certainly something that's festering. We could talk about it, you know, a little. I think one thing that people ought to be watching, you know, this coming Saturday, October 10th, is Foundation Day in North Korea. It's the 70th anniversary of the founding of that communist state. And they typically hold a large military parade. There were also reports last week that they're moving a larger ICBM than the one that was launched in 2017. So it's not to say that any of this stuff goes away. It's just there are potentially, you know, combustible pools of gasoline, and a spark could set any one of those off. I just don't know if it, in the eyes of any of our competitors or adversaries, they see a window here where they could act and make far greater gains while Trump is incapacitated and while the U.S. is seemingly in disarray. I just think so far the structure, the nature of the government in the country would not allow someone to kind of make a bold readjustment to their calculus in terms of how they think about the U.S. and what the U.S. could do.
Agreed. Although this administration is somewhat more chaotic, right? I mean, if it had been somewhat more normal and not as, I mean, this is ridiculous to say because anybody who runs and gets elected president of the United States certainly has a certain sense of their own confidence and their centrality toward the future of the nation, which is both admirable and also in a sense, sort of at a human level, somewhat terrifying source of many comedy routines, clearly. But right, I mean, this is also Trump focused. The concern is that when Trump is incapacitated, the whole system somehow might not function the way it might normally. Right, George H.W. Bush, you know, when he went to the hospital, I think it was twice, transferred power to Dan Quayle because he was being anesthetized, right? I mean, so you could argue that there were other presidents, you know, when President Reagan was shot, it was a very smooth transfer of power and the United States did everything it could to transmit to the Soviet Union. Business as usual here, even though the boss was incapacitated.
Yeah, I agree. I think it probably is shambolic. I think the main question is, you know, would someone think that they could act
right
and make a far greater gain? And that's really where I'm coming from in this discussion. I don't think Vladimir Putin's calculus in Belarus or the Baltic states would change that dramatically. Now, are there scenarios that you could walk down, or, you know, could you paint the picture that, you know, Trump, while he's hospitalized or he's on this steroid treatment, does do something, you know, bold and aggressive, like, hey, I go seize those Iranian tankers. And all of a sudden, you know, we've got another international crisis on the eve of a national election. I don't know. I think right now, you know, he's probably more focused on the election than anything else. But there are always scenarios. And as I said, you never say never.
There are still thoughtful people who have key roles in the administration, whether that's Dr. O'Brien, the national security advisor, Mark Esper at Defense, and Mike Pompeo, as well as many, many others. Matt Pottinger, highly capable and thoughtful national security leader as well. Let's transition to the Defense Security Cooperation Agency. In your note, you noted some resetting of needles, expectations. I don't know how you want to put it, you know, truth in advertising.
I mean, you know, fiscal year ended. So I think they closed out $82.5 billion in FMS cases for fiscal year 20, which was a record. But, you know, there were kind of three, what I'd say are highly questionable cases that were included in that total. And if you back those out, you're not at a record year. The three in question were an F-35 and an F-18 sale to Switzerland and a Patriot air defense sale to Switzerland. I mean, the defense security cooperation notices to Congress, they are used by analysts to kind of track where U.S. international defense sales are going. I've always had a little bit of a problem with that as an analytical foundation, because some of these DISCA notifications don't always materialize in terms of sales. The one that I usually cite is an F-18 sale that Brazil, there was a notification that Brazil was going to buy F-18s, and then that thing fell apart when Brazil pushed back on the Snowden allegations and ultimately went with the Saab Gripen. But in this instance, you know, it's weird to see notices included for competitions where the outcome hasn't even been decided yet. Right. So, you know, in the case of Switzerland, they just passed a national referendum that kind of said, okay, you can go ahead and fund this thing. But obviously the F-35 and the F-18 are going to be in competition with the Rafale and the Eurofighter in that campaign. And that's not going to get decided until 2021. And it's either going to be and if the U.S. does win, it's either going to be the F-35 or the F-18. It's not going to be both airplanes. And the same with the air defense competition. So I just think it's a reminder that, you know, more so than other years, the 2020 number is going to have an asterisk next to it to explain this. And I just think, you know, I'm sure there are reasons why this was done, but, you know, it kind of devalues the broader value of that particular metric.
Well, but isn't it politics, right? I mean, in an election year, don't you want to say, look at me, sure. I'm moving a lot of product off the lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you could, you know, credibly say we had record U.S. international sales notifications. And that's the way some people may report it. And that's the way it may be spun. But at the end of the day, you know, you've got to dig through that data. And I think most prudent analysts would do that. So it seemed like a departure. I've never seen an instance where, you know, you've kind of pre-announced competitions you know, included things where it's really, you know, there hasn't been a decision made. So,
well, I mean, it's also a question of the requirement, right? Sash Tusa and Richard Abulafia, Sash Tusa of Agency Partners and Richard Abulafia of the Teal Group join us, as you know, every Sunday for our business roundtable or world markets roundtable. And, you know, both sort of made clear the there were a lot of allies and partners that want the F-35 for its extraordinary capabilities as a strike jet, given that most nations participate in multinational operations, and the easiest way for some nations to do that, especially smaller nations, but really any nation, are getting involved in air operations. And generally, that's meant to participate in strike operations. If you look at the Swiss requirement, Switzerland doesn't participate in international missions like that as a neutral country, and is looking for something that is much more of an air defense aircraft at the end of the day. And for all the capabilities of the F-35, it's not really optimized for that mission or that role, right? I mean, so I think, again, something more like a Rafale, an F-18, a Gripen, or a Eurofighter, maybe something more in line with what the Swiss might be interested in.
I could make the case that, you know, what they may need is in a kind of a fighter version of the T-7. I mean, if you're really just looking for an interceptor to patrol Swiss airspace, you're
right, not for air policing duties. Yeah. That certainly might be the case. And I should note that they've got a large fleet of F-5 Tigers, right? Right. Which was, you know, it's one of the most beautiful airplanes ever. So I'm glad to see that they're still in service. Obviously, T-38 would be the equivalent, which the T-7 is going to be replacing. But excellent point. But I mean, one of the other points that Sash made was that the notification amount, for example, for the air defense system, was such that it's causing problems in Swiss media,
right?
Which is asking, hang on a second, that's twice the budget of what we want to spend. what on earth is that number? And I appreciate that from a DSCA perspective, they want to be as fulsome about the notification so that members of Congress have sort of as fulsome an idea of what that number could be. On the other hand, I could also see this from the standpoint of a potential customer going, hang on a second, I didn't sign up for that kind of money.
But you're right. And I think that's typical. I mean, I know some of the Patriot deals like Romania, you know, the number was much larger than anything that had been talked about. But these are, you know, over potentially the life of a potential buy. They may include options. There may be sustainment costs embedded in these. So like I said, there should be a better metric. You probably really have to go to census data on the value of U.S. defense exports. And there are, you know, that data is publicly available. But as I said, you know, some sell side analysts will take that data, as I did in my note, you know, graph it and say, okay, here it is. But I think as something that's really of analytical help, and really expressing, you know, where the U.S. is competitive globally and how that has changed over time, it's not the best metric to use.
Let's move on to the week and the events you're going to be tracking. A little bit of a lighter week, but still some interesting events. Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy is going to be talking to our good friend Brian Clark of the Hudson Institute about Project Convergence. A couple of other events. Talk to us about what you're looking forward to hearing from each of them.
Sure. You're right. On Thursday, Hudson Institute will do an event on Project Convergence. And I think that's just another one of these. It's an interesting discussion. I expect an interesting discussion, you know, really how is the Army building this network to deliver fires on targets, as fast as possible with different technologies, different assets. So I think that's worth a gander. It's kind of outside of the DC realm, but I think it's interesting. Ball Corporation, which probably most people know as the canning, mason jar company, they also have a pretty interesting space and aerospace business. So they're holding a virtual investor day on October 6th. You could go to their website and I think you can, you know, just stream the video, but, their discussion, kind of their perspective about where that business is, how is it going to fit in with future space architectures, you know, what's going on in commercial side, that'll offer a pretty interesting, maybe slightly different perspective. RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute in London, is doing an event on sanctions that I think will be U.S. sanctions policy that I think is germane to some of the things I mentioned, the Iranian Venezuelan tankers, for example. So, there are probably always going to be the pop-up events that happen as well, but it is a fairly quiet week because Congress is basically out. And I think most of the news flow is going to be centered around the president's health. And what does that really mean?
Let me ask you one last question, in part because this is an issue that you and I discussed very, very early in the pandemic about whether or not there was going to be an impact on food supplies. I remember having this conversation with a friend of mine in February, in fact, where he was worried about what these impacts would be, for example, on China. We're seeing food security issues now cropping up all around the world, and it looks like we're going into either, you know, resurgence of phase one or phase two, depending on where you are. Caseloads are increasing at record levels in some places in the country. They're increasing in New York City, fueling concern there. Obviously, Europe is already looking at exponential rises in cases. How big of an issue do you think food security is going to be, especially in a couple of months when we're in the dead of winter? Which is,
it's always
very worrying.
Yeah, it is very worrying. And I think you have to think through, there seem to be kind of two dominant thoughts on COVID-19 and its impact on security. One is that it was just going to be an accelerant of existing trends. So, deglobalization, great power competition, But then there was another school, and I kind of put myself in this, and it really is going to introduce these new stresses and strains. And the food issue is one you have to be cognizant of. You know, arguably that was a tip off for the Arab Spring, surging food prices. There have been some reports out of China that they've had surging food prices and some spot shortages, and the government's been encouraging people to not be so wasteful with food. So it's another one of those, you know, known unknowns that could have a more meaningful impact on security. I don't worry about it in the context of Europe or the United States, other than it might contribute to higher inflation. But, you know, in some of the developing parts of the world, it could just compound existing security issues. And, you know, again, as much as the Department of Defense wants to focus on great power competition, these other conflicts or the potential of other conflicts and instability are always going to be lurking.
Byron, thanks very, very much. Always a pleasure. Hope you can join us on Friday for the roundtable. Thanks a lot.
You got it, Fargo. Thank you.
Have a great week.
Yep.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.